Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and time.
Fran Lewis, I'm your host, and I'm waiting for the author of Queen of Kenosha to call in. I am emailing him as we speak, and Howard Shapiro is supposed to be here, and as of yet, he has not called in. A talented single writer slogging her way through the burgeoning Greenwich Village folk music scene of 1963, the Queen of Kenosha, Wisconsin, realizes that standing on the cusp of stardom gets her little respect and barely a cup of coffee in New York City. With her cousin Christina, a budding lawyer, and the greatest champion by her side, Nina keeps hoping for that big break. It finally comes, but in a way she could have never imagined. A chance encounter with a mysterious Nick Ladd at a late-night gig spins her life in a different direction, one that becomes a daily balance between life and death. Hold on a minute. He's finally here. Hi, good morning. I was getting worried here.
Sorry.
We are live on the air.
Held up.
Yeah, we're
here.
How you doing? Okay, and I was just giving everybody a summary of the book, and welcome to MJ Network, and this is Howard Shapiro, the author of Queen of Kenosha. So when you created the characters in this graphic novel and the main issue of taking down a Nazi group, how did you decide to create that and trying to reinstate the Fourth Reich?
Yeah, so I'd want to... last books I've done have been hockey. It had a hockey theme. They weren't necessarily hockey related, but I wanted to do kind of a action adventure drama kind of story. I had read in doing some research for the book. I read about a couple operations after World War II where Nazis were dropped off or sent to the U.S. At the end of World War II, and a really interesting book. That was called Hitler in Los Angeles, how Jews foiled Nazi plots against Hollywood in America by this guy named Stephen J. Ross. And it was a really interesting book and kind of gave me the idea from there. It was just a really interesting, doing the research really, you know, it really helped me and kind of the idea kind of sprung from there. So it was just, you know, just one of those kind of things where I wanted to do something different, and I kind of got stuck on that idea or plot and kind of ran with it and had a great editor that I worked with as well to kind of bring the plot out. So so it all kind of worked from that initial research I was doing. So.
Well, that's interesting. But before I continue the rest of the questions, I was looking through the pictures this morning and everything. How do you get the pictures on here in a graphic novel to look so realistic? I mean, people watch programs on television and characters in different kinds of graphic novels on television, and they don't look as real life as these. These look like they can just real people. How do you do that?
Well, I appreciate that. It's very nice of you to say, and I agree 100% with you. It's really the artist. It comes down to, you know, each artist has their own style, and the artist that I went with, Erica Chan, you know, she sent me her portfolio, and that was what I was looking for, in this case, like a kind of a 60s, you know, early 60s look, and she had not only accomplished that, but my fear was the action scenes, if she was going to be able to draw them. And she sent me a couple, just like really, not even rough, but really good sketches. And, you know, I was blown away. So yeah, it comes down to each specific artist in their specialty, I guess. The one guy I worked with, when I did my first one, his kind of strength was facial expressions and body language. And, that was what we were going for, 'cause it was kind of a smaller story. It wasn't like, big action pieces and all that. But, yeah, it all comes down to the artist. And there's so many talented artists. I was just really lucky to work with Erica because I thought she, you know, she just did a great job all the way through.
Yeah, she did, because the facial expressions look almost real. And the colors and stuff are real, too. And you could see even when she's thinking that she's, the character's looking up in the air and he's looking up in the air. And I'm going like, you can actually tell what they're thinking. And, of course, the ending you can really tell. Yeah. And how did you create Nina and her image as the Queen of Kenosha? And how did she become involved with this organization? But, you know, not, she didn't really mean to. She wanted to do something else. So how did she become involved
right.
in them to take down the Nazis?
Well, I wanted to work music into the story because those are the two things I like to write about most are hockey and music. You know, and they always say, you know, write what you know or write what you like. So, yeah. So I just wanted to. I was really intrigued by the Dangerous Mind movie from a few years ago with Sam Rockwell, and you know, I kind of the whole Chuck Barris story. He actually passed away while I was in the middle of writing this, and his name, you know, kind of came to fore again. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of come up with this really fun character that you know, was multidimensional and, you know, was kind of brought in, kind of walking the line between two different worlds, and I really thought that was interesting. And you know, that, like I said, the Dangerous Mind, the book and the movie were a huge inspiration and influence on that. So I was just you know, the tricky part is making it, and even one of the guys, this guy who wrote for Vulture, who picked it as one of the eight comics to read in October, he kind of said, you know, the plot, you know, on the surface is, you know, kind of, you know, I don't know, goofy or silly or something, but he said we were able to pull it off. So, you know, we wanted to have some sort of a realistic aspect where, you know, you're not making too much of a, I mean, there's always that suspension disbelief, but I didn't want it to be too much. And, you know, again, I kind of relied on Dangerous Mind to kind of help in that regard, maybe, and say, well, hey, you know, this did, you know, it didn't happen in reality, but at least it seemed plausible. So that's what we were looking for, some little bit of plausibility in how she gets kind of pulled into the operation.
Well, considering I'm a music major, I love music. recommended listening was really great. That really said a lot. And, you know, everybody that likes the music from the 60s and you want to get the old-fashioned way of listening to them, well, this is the way to find out, whatever. And it was interesting. And, of course, the poem at the end of the book is really great. The poems at the end of the book are really great. So we've got Frank, Granger, Werner, and Nick. Tell us about how they interplay in this particular book, because they're all different and interesting.
Yeah, well, thanks. You know, I like to always keep the cast kind of small, you know, maybe three or four characters. I don't like to, you know, I know some people, there's multi, you know, character upon character. And actually, the original draft, we had a few more characters, and then we kind of whittled it down. And we just wanted to come up with, you know, have the interplay between them. So you have Cullen, who's the leader, so to speak, of the group, and Granger, Granger actually works for Cullen, but Cullen, you know, sort of, you know, Granger's much more vociferous, so he's the main leader, and he's partners with Nick, and Nick, well, he was partners with Nick, and then Nina becomes Nick's partner, and Quernan is an African American character who we wanted to put in to, not only for diversity, but just to kind of be the antagonist to Granger, who is kind of, you know, xenophobic, a little racist. Again, trying to keep in that 60s, early 60s vibe where, you know, when people weren't maybe as enlightened or, you know, there wasn't as much diversity as there is today. So I just wanted to kind of a cast where they could all sort of, you know, butt heads and you know, that's, you know, I always considered Nick sort of, he's the Midwest, and then Nina's the West, and Frank's the East, and Nick is being just pulled in both directions, and he, you know, and he kind of sees both sides of things, and I just wanted to kind of have, you know, a character who, had a foot in both camps and just kind of play off each other. So it worked out really well, I think, you know, because again we just kept it really small. And then we had one character. I'm sorry, go ahead.
She even got the clothes right.
Well, you know, the fun part when you collaborate with somebody is being able to, send them, either I do a lot of Google imaging, you know, and finding mm-hmm. and wanting characters to look like. I mean, like Nick, for example, the inspiration for him was kind of a Steve McQueen look. So, mm-hmm. he sent her a lot of pictures. Erica, the illustrator, would send her a lot of pictures of Steve McQueen. And then, Granger was sort of like Efren Zimbalist Jr. when he was on the FBI show back in the 70s. And so we kind of went for those kind of looks. And I would send her pictures. Nina, for example, is kind of a cross between a very young Chrissy Hynde and Joan Jett, and then she put her own spin on it. So it was fun to kind of send the looks and then watch again her, Erica come up with put her spin on things. So made it a lot of fun to work together. And she usually nailed everything in the first take or so. Usually 90% of the time.
She even got the cover right. Seriously.
Well, we actually had a cover artist do that, but Catherine Castellino, and I love the cover. So it's like I think probably the favorite cover.
The cover's great.
Cover. Thank you.
It is great. You know, I notice everything. It's really bad sometimes. Yeah, but I do. So, what happens if? I posted your review this morning, by the way. It's there. I just have to have time later to post it on Amazon for 17 stars, but yeah. I posted something this morning for someone, and I was very diplomatic, and I posted the review. It's all over Facebook. The person, the publicist loved it, but I'm not posting it on Amazon because I would only give it 3 stars, and that was very nice.
Okay.
What can I say? Yeah. It was
yeah. Well, you're honest,
I was very honest about it, and I said, let me not post it there, because I don't post anything less than 3.5, 4 stars, and this was basically between 2.5 and 3. Oh, well. So what happens the first time she's on a – what can I do? Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, the thing is, like, people who have given – and I'm perfectly fine. Yeah, it's obviously great to get compliments. You know, you love that. That means a lot. But, you know, I always use the bad, or negative review, so to speak, as a learning experience. And anybody who was, like, really harsh, but the points they made, if they were good, I would ask them, I'd email them and say, look, I'm sorry you felt this way and it didn't do what the book was supposed to do, which is entertain you, and you didn't enjoy it. And I feel bad about that. But the point you made were very valid. And would you like to be a beta reader for my next book? So I always think that those are the people that, and most of the time I think they're blown away, like, wow, okay, yeah, sure, okay, yeah. You know, and if it's valid, I mean, there are some people who go into things and just, kind of hate everything, contrarian.
Yeah, I know.
But, I always find the bad reviews, if they're, use them as a learning experience. That's what I felt, so, or feel.
I got I got 21 reviews for my first book, and one girl said I didn't understand it, so I gave it 2 stars. I said, so why did you bother to do anything? If you didn't read the whole book, how would you know what I was talking about? I was like,
absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't,
right.
I was like, I don't even care. Yeah, at that point, it's just like, you don't have, any mind, whatever. But, yeah, I was asked to be a beta reader for somebody's book. I won't say who. And I said, if you want my honest opinion, then fine. If you don't want to know what I think, then I'm not going to do it. It took me a long time. And it wasn't that the book was bad. It was just that it was too many books in one. And I don't think the person liked what I wrote. I was honest. It wasn't bad. It was just that it was too many books in one, too many changes and whatever. So she's on a mission. And she's the first time she's on a mission. What does she learn early on about who she can trust? Because that was really a main point in the book too.
Yeah, that's a really excellent point because we did that. So the scene before that is a no text scene. Obviously it's a little bit of foreshadowing for the reader, but we don't really spell it out. And what's going to happen, and Nick's a little bit like hesitant, and Granger, excuse me, Granger's like, you know, very forceful in those illustrations. So what happens is they are supposed to capture these two Nazis, and there's a little bit of a backstory to those guys, but I don't want to spoil it, so I won't mention what their backstory is. But and Granger has a very personal interest in them, and wanting to see them dead and not captured, and so they kind of do an audible, Granger and Nick. They don't tell Nina about it, knowing that if they told her, then she might, balk or ruin the mission somehow. So it's an interesting thing, and it's kind of a test, an early test for her, is the way they kind of frame it, to see if they can trust, you know, her. And she, on the other hand, is like, well, I can't trust you guys because why wouldn't you tell me that this would happen? And they explain it to her why afterwards, and she kind of, you know, hesitates a little bit. So it's kind of a test on all fronts, you know, between Nick and Granger and Nina and Nick and Granger. So, it was a fun scene to do because it that kind of plays through throughout the rest of the book, the amount of trust. And she really believes in the mission, and she's very black and white. Everything, you know, there's no gray area. And she learns that, you know, with these guys, they're willing to get to the line and cross it, and she's not, as far as, you know, trampling on civil rights and the Constitution. So it brings up a good little, the tension between the three of them. It's a fun dynamic between them. So that was a really fun scene to do because it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the book.
Well, that's the reason why I thought she was a really, you know, strong character, because I felt that she's got moral ethics, and she wasn't going to compromise herself. So I said, well, that's good, because how many people would have cared? A lot of people would have said, well, I'm on a mission, I have to do it their way, and it doesn't matter. So that was interesting.
No, that's... So. Yeah, no, I really appreciate that. That's because that's exactly what we were going for, you know. And she's a very idealistic character, you know, this kind of goes back a little bit to another influence on the book was the television show 24, especially their first season, which I really loved. And it became this whole issue of, you know, well, the government's doing, again, maybe trampling on your civil rights, but it's for your own good. So just kind of like, you know, deal with it, you know, we know what's right. And I kind of want to bring that to this book as well. And it's like, you know, these guys are like, you know, these guys are evil, and we have to get rid of them at all costs. And she's like, yeah, I agree, but not at all costs, that there's justice and there's, you know, civil liberties and there's, you know, jurisprudence and, you know, it was really important. I thought, I'm glad you pointed that out as well, that she not kind of like, oh, well, yeah, I guess, yeah, you're right. She's very, very convicted, has a lot of conviction. And, you know, that's something that I really wanted to bring out in the character. And so it's great that that came across. So I appreciate the kind words on that, because that's really what we were going for. We didn't want her to be kind of, okay, well, yeah, you're right. But, you know, well, okay, she's very, you know, she butts heads with him. And, you know, she's a very strong woman. And that's one of the things we also wanted to bring out.
Well, she is. That's why I like her, because she's so like me. It's scary. Really. Yeah,
I should have.
I was a test coordinator for my school because I was a reading expert, and the Board of Ed called and said that they didn't like my scores for the writing test, and they felt that I should do it over. And we were honest. Six classes, and three passed and three failed. And they said, well, maybe you need to redo it. I said, maybe you need to not ask me to do something I would never do. When I went over to my principal and I told her, I said, this is up to you, but I won't take a part in it. And not only did she go along with me, but she called them and said, we don't do that here. And the state audited every single one of my 1,500 papers and sent a note back and apologized and said that they were wrong and that I was right and that there was not one score that they could question. And I said to her, you see, that's because I wouldn't compromise, whatever. Sure, the school would look great, and if the writing test, if everybody passed. But I would have gotten suspicious if every child passed. Seriously, that doesn't happen.
No, yeah.
So, yeah,
she's
my kind of person. So we've got her cousin and her singing career. So how does that interplay with that? And how does she use, how does using that help promote her cover? That's kind of clever,
well,
too.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Yeah, she, you know, we wanted to, you know, have a sort of a confidant, you know, with her cousin Christine, the character, and you know, kind of play off of her, and then also Nick as well, and gave them each, you know, a little bit of a backstory, Nina and Christine, and it was, you know, she was also kind of a fun character to write, and I want to give her, you know, spoil things for her, how things work out. But she's a really good character because, again, she's sort of there and is very supportive of Nina, and really Nina's low period, she's you know, always kind of bringing her up and helping, and wants her to realize her dream. And you know, she's going to be a really fun character to write in the next book. We already have some ideas we're kicking around for that. So you know, it was the interplay between the two of them. It was actually much more. You know, we ended up cutting a lot of it out from the draft. There was a lot more interplay between them, but we ended up cutting some of that out, which was probably for the best. But she was another really, really fun character to write. And probably, you know, kind of like the dark horse, most interesting character in the book, I think, or at least I feel.
Yes,
that
she
way.
Was. She was, and especially that last scene, and I won't give that away on the last page. I knew.
Right.
I knew there was going to be a sequel. You see how I know these things.
Yes, you're very perceptive. You're very perceptive. Yeah, no, we.
That's what they claim.
Yeah.
Can I tell you? So I have to transgress once more time. Do you have all the songs at the end? Do you ever have music to them? I would love to hear, you know, what those poems sound like in music. Circle
no,
of Perception. These are really good poems, seriously.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I've always been a kind of a frustrated song lyricist, so I was able to kind of get that out of my system here. No, it's fun because, you know, the whole idea is, you know, you mentioned the recommended listening songs, and so the way that it went throughout the book is the first song was always, you know, female artists, you know, and it kind of jumped around between 60s, 70s, and 80s, whatever, even and current female musicians. And then the next song would have been a song that I was listening to when I was either writing it, that chapter, or was an influence on that chapter, et cetera. And then the third song was always a original, quote-unquote, Nina song, even though, again, these don't exist. And I explained that in the letter, the author letter, sort of up front. And, they were just fun. I mean, what I did, and I was able to knock those off pretty quick because they were each the Nina songs, again, and there's no music to them. It's, again, just the lyrics. They were just having to do with each specific chapter, you know. So if you read the lyrics, and you know, it kind of pertains to that particular chapter. So I thought that was kind of a neat thing. Like when she's getting, you know, kind of butting heads with Granger, and he's like, you know, well, you have to listen to me. And she's like, no, you have to listen to me, kind of thing. That song reflects that kind of, you know, you're not going to silence me, kind of thing. And, you know, one song towards the end about Nick, how she, you know, is kind of falling for him and he might be falling for her. That's kind of reflected in there, but they feel like there's this wall between them. So, it was fun. It was a really fun thing to do. And I've never done that before. And we came up with a guy I work with, artist, did a great job with like a 60s-ish, early 60s album cover. So, the next book we'll explain how all that worked out with that first album of hers. So it was just fun to do and something different. You know, I was trying to do something different or try and add to the, you know, to, you know, I mean, like when I was growing up, I would always, when I buy albums, you know, specifically, you know, I always, the first thing I go look for is the lyric sheet and see who produced it and who was, you know, playing bass and all that. I love that kind of stuff. So we kind of nixed the whole, we put the lyric sheet in there, but we didn't put like a whole liner notes. I just kind of ran out of time. So I was going to do that as well. So, it was fun to do. That was a nice little thing, and hopefully people get a kick out of it.
Well, I did because my dad had a friend that was the vice president or president of Sam Goody's. So he had all these lovely albums. And, yeah, he was. And it was like, okay, you know, what if you get all A's this week, I'll let you go in and ask Saul, and he'll get you the top 10 or whatever you wanted. Well, of course I got all A's. Mm-hmm. I knew better than not to. With my mother, yeah, I got hundreds on every test. Oh, good. And I would just say, Dad, these are the ones I wanted. And it was amazing. And the albums, I gave them away to someone because I didn't have any room here. Old ones, really old ones. I should have kept them. But, yeah, nobody buys albums or cassettes or tapes anymore. And it's funny because my niece had a homework assignment that I helped her with yesterday. Should artists use advertising to promote their music? And that was the question of the day because that was interesting. I had various points of view to help her with. So, interesting that music comes into everything. So tell us how they take down Ratchets. Who is he? And who is he in relation to the Nazis? And why do they take him? And when they do the interrogation, I've read thousands of books. This really hit home. It made sense that they would be so not so nice.
Yeah, that character is actually going back to I can't think of the name of the movie. The Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin. I can't think of it off the top of my head. But that character is sort of based on the Charles Grodin character. So he's the accountant for or the money man, so to speak, for this Nazi cell, this huge Nazi cell, and he's coming into New York with money for this operation that they're doing. So they get a tip that he's coming into town through. And he's taking a train from Chicago, and so they do this. And that was like the first action scene we wrote, and it was really fun because I kind of choreographed it myself and kind of came up with all the action scenes, and so that was a really neat thing to do. And but yeah, so that's part of it. That's like the first part. The second part is the interrogation, and this is where Nina's eyes really get open to like these guys are rendition is something very serious, and these guys are. They're not just they're not going to capture him and have him have a lawyer and guy go through read his Miranda rights, etc. They're like he's a big deal, and we're going to get as much information on him as we can and completely trample over his civil rights, even though he is a U.S. citizen. And
if somebody lawyers up, then they can't do anything. If somebody lawyers up, then they can't do that.
Yeah,
or they don't care.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's the thing. They're just like he's an enemy of the state, and and so they, and eventually the other side finds out that he's been captured, and they find out where he's at, and they do something about it, and that's part of the story. I don't want to give that away, but it was really interesting that kind of interrogation. That goes back also to 24, where they would. They would use various, civil rights like where they completely trample over them, and they get the information they think they need by any means necessary, and that's what these guys are, especially Granger, and it kind of shows where his head's at, and so that seems a real eye opener for Nina, especially because she realizes he's completely lost his mind in a way, and he's he will go across any line, and she realizes that this isn't going to be, a by-the-books kind of operation. And so it becomes again, it kind of continues that pattern that she saw earlier, and she's a little concerned that, they're doing anything to get what they need, and she doesn't approve of that, and she's very vocal about that. So that was a kind of a pivotal scene, and I really liked writing that. So, yeah, but he's based on that Charles Grodin character because I love – that's going to drive me crazy until I figure out remember the name of the movie, but he was kind of based on that character.
Well, you can even look through the book, and for those people that are, there are a lot of people that don't read, and they just look at pictures, they could get the whole story just by looking at the pictures, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, the pictures tell it all. The only thing is that it took me a little bit longer to read this because the print is so small.
That was something that came up.
That's a problem. Yeah, the print is small, and it's hard to read sometimes. But I was able to follow it. I'm saying, the guy's wearing sunglasses, and then there's whatever happened at the school. You could feel it. and you could feel the emotion at the end of the book. But I said they need to make the writing bigger for me.
Yeah, it's definitely a good point. Yeah, we try and use like a six panel kind of we use a six panel. I mean that's sort of like our template. You know, five or six panels each page, and we actually made that one 6x9, which again isn't much different than the 5.5x8.5. It adds a little bit, I think you're right. And you never really know until you get the printed page, which is unfortunate. You know, when you're seeing on the computer screen, everything looks fine, and it's, you know, especially in high res, it looks great and all that. And then you get the printed page, it's like, oh, that's a little small, and like I can't read them off of. I mean, I'm a kind of a traditionalist. I love the paper anyway. I'm not an e-book person, but you get an e-book fashion in that format, it's like impossible to read, at least for me. So yeah, I'm with you.
No,
I appreciate that.
I just read regular print books and whatever. As a matter of fact, someone just sent me a book. I won't say it's about 9,000 pages, and the print is smaller than the plain print in here.
Jeez.
And I'm going to tell them, I'm supposed to read it. I can't even see it. So what was their goal? Who is Alex, and what happens when Warner wants more money? There's a whole big other plot here that was really interesting.
Yeah, so, you know, thanks. Yeah, we kind of came up with this Alex character who's like, we didn't want to give away who that is, at least in this book, you know, and thinking for the next one, but we wanted to kind of have that shadowy figure, you know, who's kind of, the puppet master, who's running everything, and we kind of came up with that character, and so nobody knows who he is or she is, you know, and we had some characters in mind or had other movies in mind, like Blofeld on James Bond, that kind of thing. So but Warner's sort of the double agent, and he's an interesting character because they think he is a Nazi, and but he's a double agent, so they need him, and that becomes an issue with Nina and Nick, where Nina's like, well, you know, he's putting his life on the line for us to help us, and we're going to dispose of him as soon as we're done, and Nick is like, yeah, well, he's until the information he provides, you know, until we don't need him anymore, we're going to keep him, by our side. But then, we're going to let him go. And, he's kind of a shifty character. And, towards the end, he really, he realizes that the walls are closing in on him and he's got to get out. And so that provides for a little, some really interesting pages that we did with him, and he was a fun character to write also, because again he kind of puts on this air that he's very suave and everything, and yet he's they consider him a rat, and it's just a fun, he was a really kind of fun character to write, because it was not just like one track, he's a double agent, and just like, oh, he's a bad guy or whatever. He had little flashes of like, yeah, he has some humanity to him as well, which again, it's all the kind of characters I like to write where they're not just kind of stock figures, and they each have like Granger, for example, is very he's a very strong character, and he's very America, but he also has flashes of craziness, and then also he's a family man, so it's you kind of like to write characters that are very have a lot of depth to them, and not just kind of like one note characters. So Warner was really cool. I really liked him.
I like him too. But before I forget, Monday we have the author of Criminal Misdeeds on next Thursday. This is like so exciting. Colin Eggers, Imposter's War, on the 30th. Another one of my favorite people, Bruce Coffin, Beyond the Truth. And on the 1st, James Heyman, Fatal Obsession. And I met him at the Thriller Fest, and I just walked up to him. I said, how come I never read your books? And he handed me one and got two interviews On the 5th, I have Patricia Hale, a Scar Tissue. On the 7th, one of my other favorite people, John Land. He's doing the Murder, She Wrote series, Manuscript for Murder. On the 12th, I've never done this before, but I'm going to interview a Vietnam vet who never got his benefits. And we hope that by the time we finish the reading it, he's using the name I Am Waiting. He's older, and the book is really, it brought tears to my eyes, and it's called In My Mother's Honor. On the 14th, Tess Gerrinson will be taken center stage with her movie, Island Zero. On the 20th, New York Times author Vincent Zandri, Flower Man. On the 26th, a former DEA SWAT detective will talk about Network Exposed. And the end of the month, on the 28th, Artie Van Wy will talk about his experiences and why he hasn't got through over 9/11. He's a 9/11 survivor, and the book is called 9/11, and that's just November and October. Wait till December, you know, I don't even know what I'm going to come up with. So, can you tell us more about Frank and why he's so bent on doing things violent? And he, you know, Ratchin better watch out because he's not going to make it with this guy around.
Yes, you know, he, again, without giving too much away, he actually has a very personal issue or stake in this. And again, I don't want to give it away. It was we did that scene as a no text scene, which is really excellent. I thought Erica did a really good job drawing that one. He really lashes out, and again, the personal story behind it is brought out, and why he is so violently, you know, opposed, and this is more of a personal thing for him, especially the one scene you mentioned, the first mission that Nina goes on. So, he's just really. You know, it really becomes personal for him, and it becomes an issue. You know, Nina's like, you know, kind of taken aback by all this, and she's like, I believe in the mission, but this isn't really what I signed up for, as far as, you know, the lines that they're willing to cross. So, it's very, very personal to Frank and Granger, and it makes for I think a really interesting dynamic between them.
Yes, it did. So, then you have a page that scared the daylights out of me because I turned around and I said, I didn't see that coming, and it said, boom. And you could feel the explosion. So how come you included that about the school, and who called it in? And what do we learn about Werner at that point that might, you know, turn us around even more to like him? Or not. We never know.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean... A friend of mine who kind of helped me, not necessarily the editor, but another friend of mine who's in the publishing business who I sent the original manuscript to, said, brought up a really good point when it comes to the group, you know, the Nazis that they're going up against. And it's like, you know, you can, because that scene was a little different, you know, in the draft that I did. And she brought up a really good point, which is like, if you're going to, you know, have these guys, you know, and you're going to use, you know, they're going to be the opposition, so to speak, you know, you really can't play it safe. You know, you really have to, you know, show that they would go to any length to accomplish their mission. And it got me thinking, you know, yeah, I guess in a way, yeah, we do have to. We have to kind of go and push things a little bit. So yeah, there's a bombing at an elementary school, and they say how it was kind of contained to like just a very small area. But they could, you know, then their threat, the Nazis threat, because the group had captured Ernest Ratchins, that character, this is like their retribution. And I was a little hesitant at first, and I thought, yeah, you know what, it really is, that's pretty good advice. I think we have to kind of show that they will go to any length to accomplish their goals and send a message, so to speak. And it was tough. It was just one of those things where I just thought, you know what, that's, is it crossing a little bit of a line, you know, having a school, you know, we had, and we actually trimmed down some of the, we had like a, you know, in the rubble there was going to be like a teddy bear and all this stuff. You know, and we kind of cut some of that stuff out. You know, we didn't want to really play that up. It really came from the advice of a friend who said, you know, again, you know, you might want to take it a little further, and so that's what we did. So, Erica, really, we wanted that so when you turn the page that, you know, you see that, you know, because, again, the first page, like you said, is a no-text page, and then you see the explosion. Mm-hmm. So, shock value, but, you know, hope it worked.
Well, the no-text pages really speak for themselves, and you can feel... Yeah, but especially that last page that says to be continued and the face of the person. I mean, yeah, that was interesting, you know, at the end. And
thank
of course,
you.
what happens at the last scene, we won't say what that is, what happens. And you could feel the tension and the pain. And even when the word says vroom and things explode, I go like, oh, my God, you know, you can almost tell. So... what is the real talk? What happens when everyone learns the truth about behind everything? That sort of changes everything.
Yeah, well, you know, it's you know, we're kind of, you know, the idea is that we're going to make this, the hope is, again, if they do, if the book does well enough, this one, you know, we'll get to do two more and make it, you know, I mean, my mm-hmm. idea was a span Nina's life. So here, you know, in this book, she's in her 20s, you know, she's 22. And the next book we're aiming to have it in the 80s, around when MTV started,
mm-hmm.
in, you know, the very early 80s, like 82, 83, that range.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last book where she's looking back at her life and she's in her late 70s or early 80s. The idea is to kind of go through her life and, again, kind of combining the music with the, you know, the kind of the spy stuff. And so, yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm in the process of writing the synopsis and then the draft now. We'll see how it plays out. I have to get together again with my editor, who's really wonderful when it comes to storytelling and character development. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens. But, you know,
You have the music of the 60s, so now you have the music of the 80s, right?
That's true. Yes, I mean that's there's I already have a few things in mind for that, but it's fun to kind of, I've never done that before,
mm-hmm.
where you take the character, I find her very interesting, and I really, you know, I hope that people find that, you know, people who read the book as well, that they want to read more about the Nina character. And we have some really pretty good ideas, I think, and we'll see if we can get them down on paper and flesh it out a little bit. So see how all that works out. But I wanted to, you know, the idea of this was going in was, yeah, we definitely want to do three, because I, you know, kind of sketched it on my mind. And hopefully with the next book, it won't be one of those. I mean, I'm not a big fan of, you know, if you have a sequel and then the writer, whoever does the, whether it's TV or movies or whatever, where you have to kind of go back to season one or the first. You know,
yeah.
I want to kind of make it so that, you know, but in this case, I think you almost have to, just because of the way it ends, and you have to see how that kind of, what happened in the first book. So we'll see. Hopefully, again, this one will do good enough that we can get the opportunity to do a second.
Well, I hope so. You know, I find that I'm reading over 8,000 couple of hundred books, seriously, I have. That's what they tell me. When I get a sequel sometimes, the author spends more time telling what happened in the first two books than getting to the next one, and then I go like, I knew that already. I don't need to read it. But then if there are people that didn't read it, that's different. By the way, I was talking to someone this morning on the phone, and I was telling the person about, you know, who I was interviewing, and the person went, are you kidding me? I got to have the book, so I have to bring the book over to the person. She wants it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's great. Well,
as a matter of fact, it's funny because I told a couple of people that I was interviewing you, and everybody's like, I know who that is. I know who that is. And somebody just, you know, it's like a lottery. Who's going to get the book? Yeah, this girl wants it. So the ending lets us know
great.
That there's more. We know that. And there is someone at the end of the book letting us know that they're still out there and they're planning to do more damage. We know that. So if Nina could speak to readers, what would she say about her journey so far? What would she tell them?
That is an excellent question. I would say that, you know, and we kind of talked about this a little earlier, that, you know, stand up for what you believe in, and regardless of, you know, what either somebody else says or what, you know, people are making you feel, you know, she is very, like I said, very idealistic and very moralistic, and, you know, she's not going to waver from that. So that would be what I would take, is that, you know, can, you know, have your beliefs and stick to them, and don't let anybody tell you any different. And it's almost, in a way, it's kind of a I don't know, maybe a metaphor for what I've always felt with writing. When I go to schools or elementary schools, or I go to this one college every semester and speak to writing classes, and one thing I always tell them is, if you want to do this, I mean, you don't necessarily have to, you know, there's only one J.K. Rowling, there's only one Stephen King, you know, et cetera. You know, if you're doing it to be famous or whatever, you're probably not going to make it. But, you know, writing is something that's very fun and enjoyable and cathartic and so forth. And, you know, and if you do want to pursue it, either, again, as a sideline or whatever, you know, when you're pitching it, whether it's agents, publishers, et cetera, you have to have the best belief in yourself. You know, you get, you know, you send 100 things out and 98 of them will be rejections, or maybe all 100 will be rejections, and you just have to keep going, and you have to have an incredible belief in yourself and in your work. And in a way, she has that, where not only are the music, you know, where she's, you know, a musician, and she has this incredible belief in herself, and, you know, that she, you know, feels like she is a great, in her own way, a great singer-songwriter, and she's going to make it someday, kind of thing. She also has that belief in, you know, in the stuff that she finds important, which, again, civil liberties, you know, the Constitution, et cetera. And she, you know, she believes that, in that. And, you know, there, a lot of times in the book, the men, and this is an early 60s version of mansplaining, are trying to tell her that, no, this is, you know, you have to, you can't necessarily believe that, because these guys aren't playing by the rules, so we can't play by the rules. And she's like, well, if that's their issue, but I'm in control of this, and I'm not going to cross those lines. So that's what I would take out, is that, again, have a belief in yourself and what you believe in, regardless of what anybody else says.
Who are you going to bring back in the next one, before I ask one more question about Christina? Who are you going to bring back in the next one? I know who's not coming back, but I'm not going to say.
Yeah.
And that ending was like, excuse me, how could you do that? I was like, oh, my God. Then, you know, of course, if you're like the soap operas, you don't really know what's going to happen to someone.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true. And you know, I always felt like there has to be stakes, you know. I you know, which is the funny thing, like, with the, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine here at work. We were talking about the Marvel movies and how, you know, how many times has one character died and then they come back in the next movie,
uh-huh,
or they're reincarnated? Or, I mean, it's just like you're kind of, you know, it's like you're screwing with the audience. I mean, nobody wants anybody to die, obviously, or especially a character that you really love. But, you know, I always felt like there's got to be some sort of stakes in the, you know, to make your writing, you know, complete and enjoyable. So, yeah, so the Granger character will be back. Nina will be back. Christine will be back. And those are the three for right now. And again, it's a very small cast anyway, but you know, those are the characters that will definitely be back in the sequel. So looking forward to hopefully bringing them back in 20 years later, or 20 or 21 years later, and the readers will get a little backstory on how they what they've done in those 20 years since. So, and actually, you know, this is a really good point you brought up before about,
mm-hmm,
when some writer doing a sequel, or, you know, and they mm-hmm, taking so much time to explain all this stuff. What my plan was right off the bat to explain or get everyone caught up, and I have a vehicle that I'm going to use to do that. But yeah, I was the same way. I'm like, we'll get all this out front. You know, this is what's happened in the intervening years, and now we can start. So it brings even somebody new up to speed on what, you know, what's sort of happened. And, you know, so but that was a really good point you brought up, because I'm the same way. It's like, you know, sometimes it's like you're belaboring that point of bringing it up over and over and over again. What happened? You didn't want to do that. So I'm going to get it all out of the way right up front and move on.
A lot of times, one or two authors, and I thought this was really good, because instead of belaboring it during the book and telling everybody, okay, this is what happened, and then backstory and then flashbacking, they'll go to the beginning of the book and they'll just write a summary of the first one. So for those of you that didn't read it, this is what happened in the first book, and we're moving on. And a lot of times I'll say, is your book going to start where it ended? And they'll say to me, no, we started in a different place. I go, well, why did you end it that way when you're leaving people wondering what's going to happen next? And that's like, that annoys me. Because basically, if it's ending in a specific spot, it doesn't have to start exactly there, but it should sort of have some kind of flow, like, okay, I know this happened at the end of the book. Well, what's next? Well, this one leaves a mystery, so that's good. This one leaves a total mystery.
Yeah, no, I feel the same way, you know. Although I will say one thing that, you know, I was talking with somebody here at work about the trailer for the next Creed, you know, movie, based on, you know, the Rocky story. And one of the things, again, this is a movie, so it's completely different than a book, but one of the things I always thought was kind of neat was how they started, you know, the sequels right after the end of the previous book.
And
then jump ahead, but I always thought that was kind of cool. But yeah, no, I'm with you 100% on flashbacks. I'm not a big fan of doing those either. Only in certain cases. There was one actually. I was writing the synopsis where there is a bit of a flash. There is a flashback in the next story for this series. And but yeah, that's the only one I really want to do, because that's going to be a vital one. But yeah, you don't want to get too heavy into that. You know, it kind of bogs things down for sure.
So before we end in a few minutes, where can everybody learn more about you and your work? I love the ones about hockey, and I love the premise behind the drugs and hockey. Yeah, and what I really like was that this is so different than all the other books that I get to read. And I said, oh, good, now I could sit, put my feet up and read something. And like my dad used to read the comics, but not the comic, not the romance stuff. He used to read the classics in comics. Back then, he said there were like The Tale of Two Cities, Great Expectation, all of them, Little Women were in comics, and he saved them for me because I'm a reader and I've been reading since I'm three, I think, for real. And I love reading the comics, the classic comics, because the vocabulary was harder than in the novel. And I read the original Little Women when I was eight. Yeah, scary. But my mother made me read 10 books a week, seriously, besides 90 hours of homework and Hebrew lessons and violin and piano, and I hated dancing lessons. That's another horrible story. And, and I had to take notes on them. So by the time the book review was done, I had it. I still do. You should see what I did. Your book, I couldn't do it to because it's graphic and I didn't want to write in it. But in most books, I destroy them. I dog air, I circle, I write. And by the time I finish the book, I have it memorized in my head. So seriously. So where can everyone learn more about you, your work, and your graphic novels, and what message do you want people to come away with after reading this one, and why? Because this is really good. I like it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Fran. I appreciate that. Yeah, no, it means a lot. And, I'll talk the second one first as far as what I'd like somebody to come out after reading it is, you know, I always go back to this and, you know, I was saying how when I go to the elementary schools and, you know, college, I always mention this, and, you know, to me, the, you know, books are, you know, a form of entertainment, and you have to entertain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I put in a very subtle message you mentioned about the drug usage and on the other books, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there was talk about gender. There's a lot of stuff I try and stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that was interesting.
In a good way.
Yeah.
You know, we did that. There was the gender equality issue. You know, aging, all these kind of things that you know, after you read it, you might think, oh, well, yeah, I guess, yeah, so women are making 63% of what men are, and, you know, things like that. And in this book, you know, again, how the importance of the Constitution and civil liberties and, you know, the habeas corpus and all these issues that, you know, you might not have thought when you're reading it, but afterwards, after you think, oh, yeah, that did touch on that, but not to do all that kind of stuff in a very heavy-handed way. You know, so that's what I kind of like, you know, when it's very subtle and you let the person decide, you know, if it's okay for the government to tap your phones or whatever to protect against, you know, terrorist attacks. So, yeah. So
and they do. You know, when I thought about the school before we have about four minutes, I thought about the school. I thought about Parkland last year, and I thought about the fact that my niece texted me from school to say that her school was locked down. And then my other niece
in Florida
said that she was, one goes to a special school and the other one goes to a private school. And Katie told me that she was sitting under her desk for 3 hours until they finally told them that they can come out. That it was the scariest thing in the world because the school was right next door to it. And it was horrendous. And then they had that march outside and my family was all there. You know, outside the, the school that in Parkland, and it's scary. It was really scary. And so every morning, this may sound insane, but every morning I text her to have a safe day and be careful. And I text my other one too.
Yeah.
Every morning, have a great day and be careful. They don't know why I'm doing it, but I worry.
Yeah.
I mean, I said, you know what? The world's so crazy today, and that one is doing better, and the other one is a straight-A student like her aunt, and she's going for forensic psychiatry. It's too much. And I just worry because, you know, Florida, a lot of things happen. It happens everywhere, but more there, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
That's unfortunate. I mean,
And that's why, so, when you had the school incident, I said that made it true to life because that could really happen. And sometimes they target schools like they did last week. They have a couple. And they target schools purposely because they don't think that the security is tight. And I worked in a school for 1,000 years. And, yeah, people got through. People came up to your room, and they weren't supposed to be there. I was in school at 6:30 and quarter to 7 in the morning to take a group of kids that came on their time. And they came up to the room. I wasn't worried. But, you know, you got parents sometimes that come in and go like, you're here? Oh, nice to see you. I never had a problem because it was just me. But there were others that they came in, I mean, with weapons and stuff, some of the parents, and you have to really be careful. And principals have to be careful. And we didn't have a metal detector. We had nothing.
Wow, yeah. I mean, I remember when they first started putting those in, and everyone's like, oh, this is like, you know, it's crazy. And now it's like, you know, you expect it. And, that's something, unfortunately, that you'll never forget, you know, being under the table like that. I mean, that's terrible to go through that, you know.
I know.
But yeah, I mean, it's I guess the world we live in these days. But so I mean, that would be pretty much it. Just that, you know, to come out of the book with you get those kind of, you know, things to think about, but also that you're entertained. And as far as first question, as far as contacting and so forth, if you go to Animal Media Group, all one word, www.animalmediagroup.com, you know, there's info there, and books are on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all the usual outlets. And and feel free to people can email through the Media Group website. My personal website or my personal email is hockeyplayer. The number 4life@gmail.com. So, I really appreciate that and hope your listeners will check the book out for sure.
Oh, I think they will. I want to thank you so much, everyone. I can't believe the sun is shining. It was raining before. It's beautiful up here now, and it's freezing, though. It's only 54 degrees. It's hot. I don't need a jacket. Great. So thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to the next one and the next interview. Everybody have a great day, and bye.
Thank you, Fran.